Don't let it dominate. Don't let it take over your lives. Don't let that happen.
The U.S. president tries to downplay the threat of COVID-19. This is Thursday, the 8th of October, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead, a new survey shows what the people of many nations think of China and the U.S. A new road system in India draws the ire of China. As the weather warms in Australia, their famed beaches close. And with voting already underway in the U.S., the story of a group providing pizza to the polls. It is all on today's VOA Asia. With Election Day less than a month away, many Americans have voted early or voted by mail. Many more are expected to do so between now and November 3rd. Former Vice President and Democratic candidate Joe Biden has been campaigning in the swing state of Florida, while President Donald Trump, who is recovering from COVID-19, has vowed to be back on the campaign trail soon. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has more.
President Donald Trump is back in the White House recovering from COVID-19, saying on social media he is looking forward to a scheduled October 15th debate with Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden in Miami. In a separate recorded video posted on Twitter, Trump had the following message about the illness that put him in the hospital.
Don't let it dominate. Don't let it take over your lives. Don't let that happen. We're the greatest country in the world. We're going back. We're going back to work. We're going to be out front. As your leader, I had to do that. I knew there's danger to it, but I had to do it. I stood out front. I led.
But Trump's handling of his illness and approach to the pandemic is being criticized by Joe Biden, who spoke during an NBC News town hall Monday night.
These masks, they matter. It matters. It saves lives. It prevents the spread of the disease. Social distancing. Instead of talking about what the only thing I heard was one of the tweets saying that, you know, don't be so concerned about all this, essentially. There's a lot to be concerned about. 210,000 people have died.
Biden has been campaigning in the battleground state of Florida, a critical state in the presidential contest.
As you all know, and quite frankly, if we win Florida, you've won.
While Biden has been leading Trump in national polls, a new poll this week shows Trump is tied with Biden in Florida, a state Trump won in 2016. Voters 65 years and older are a key demographic in the U.S. because they are the most committed, says political analyst Rayfield Sonnenschein.
What seems to be happening under the surface is that Biden's small lead among older voters, an absolute bedrock for Republicans, is increasing.
Wednesday's vice presidential debate in Salt Lake City is the next major event on the campaign agenda. It is now even more relevant following Trump's illness.
It reminds everybody that there's a 74-year-old running against a 77-year-old for president, and two considerably younger people, one the vice president, the other running for vice president, who could easily be the next candidates on the ticket.
The debate styles of Vice President Mike Pence and Vice Presidential candidate Kamala Harris are likely to be different. Harris is a former prosecutor, Pence a former governor and radio talk show host. As head of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, Pence will likely be defending the administration's response to COVID-19. The outcome of the presidential race, says political analysts, will ultimately be a referendum on President Trump's handling of the coronavirus pandemic. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now at voanews.com. At the UN, 39 countries condemn China's abuses of Uyghurs. Taiwan laid to rest former President Lee Teng-hui, called Mr. Democracy. Thailand will offer tax incentives to spenders to boost domestic consumption and revive an economy stumbling from the impact of the pandemic. The UN wants Bangladesh to do more to end child marriage. Bangladesh has 38 million girls who wed before they were 18. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. We continue on VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melbourne. Negative perceptions of China have increased sharply in many of the world's advanced countries, especially Australia and Britain, according to a new survey from the Pew Research Center. This poll comes as China is engaged in multiple trade and diplomatic disputes with its neighbors and other countries around the world, driven in part by a more aggressive diplomatic approach. We welcome to VOA Asia Laura Silver, a senior researcher at the Pew Research Center. Laura, tell us about the relationship found by the survey of perceptions of both the U.S. and China.
In the United States, the last three surveys that we've done, we've found record unfavorable views towards China at that point in time. At this point in the United States, we have 73% who have an unfavorable view of China.
Why is this? Does the survey go into that?
So we're unable to say causally why people have increased their negative attitudes towards China. But we can point towards a couple of things that we think play a role based on our statistical analyses. One of them, perhaps unsurprisingly, given the context in which we're reporting, and I know you and I are both recording from home, one of them is the COVID-19 pandemic. So we generally see that people who think that China has done a bad job handling the COVID-19 outbreak are more likely to have an unfavorable view of China. The same is actually true when it comes to the United States as well. People who think that the U.S. has done a bad job handling the COVID-19 outbreak are more likely to have an unfavorable view of the United States. But that's probably not the only factor. Again, we can't say causally, but we've seen in other surveys that we've done, including in the United States where we asked more detailed questions, we can tell, for example, that people who think that the economic ties between the U.S. and China are bad are more likely to have an unfavorable view of China. So some of the rise that we've seen in the United States has come amid the context of the trade war, and that does likely play a role.
What about the leaders of these two countries, Trump and Xi Jinping?
So we also see in this survey that views of Xi Jinping have turned very negative. So a median of 78% say they have no confidence in Chinese President Xi to do the right thing when it comes to international affairs, and at least 7 in 10 in every one of these countries say they lack confidence in him. It's at unprecedented highs in every country for which we have trend data available, except for Japan and Spain. So definitely a large increase in terms of negative perceptions of Xi.
What's your overall summation of this survey, and what do you think it might contribute to the current situation?
My overall summation is that the current state of the world suggests that people across these 14 countries generally have very negative attitudes towards both the U.S. and China, and they tend to see both countries having done a particularly poor job handling the COVID-19 outbreak, and that's dragging down image of both of the countries. So while the United States may have a leadership change in the near future, it's not clear what that would mean in terms of perceptions of the U.S. going forward. And with no leadership change on the horizon, likely in China, it's definitely interesting and worth monitoring how these countries, both historic alliances as well as countries on the periphery of these two countries, are going to see these two superpowers going forward.
Laura Silver, a senior researcher at the Pew Research Center. Thanks for being with us. Happening now in Asia. China said that the United States should stop its unprovoked attacks and accusations against China, accusing U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo of maliciously creating political confrontation and smearing Beijing. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We are very happy you are with us on VOA Asia. India is racing to build a network of roads to its disputed border with China as a military standoff between the two countries that began in May drags into winter. These roads will connect to military bases in border areas and help swiftly deploy troops and equipment to Ladakh in the Himalayan mountains. But as Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi, India's rapid infrastructure development has fueled more friction with China.
The nearly 9-kilometer-long tunnel, dug beneath the Himalayas at more than 3,000 meters, will bypass a snowbound mountain pass in winter and cut the journey by 46 kilometers to Ladakh, where Indian and Chinese forces are confronting each other. Straddling the India-China border, the cold desert of Ladakh in northern India has emerged as a flashpoint while both countries spar over their disputed frontier. Inaugurating the Atal Tunnel, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi said the tunnel will help troops.
Taking care of the needs of those who protect our country is one of the main priorities of this government.
The world's longest high-altitude tunnel will enable quicker mobilization of troops and equipment to the Chinese border. It took 10 long years to complete. But India is now blasting mountainsides as it races to expedite construction of more roads amid its worst military standoff with Beijing in decades. These will give crucial all-year-round access to Ladakh, where supplies have to be airlifted in winter months when key roads get buried under heavy snow. India's rapid construction in the Himalayas is one of the reasons fueling tensions with Beijing.
China does not recognize the so-called Central Territory of Ladakh, illegally established by India. We also oppose the construction of infrastructure for the purpose of military control in the disputed border areas.
But India is pressing ahead. The government has doubled spending on border infrastructure as it seeks to close the gap with China's superior network of roads and helipads on its side.
The Sino-Indian military balance itself has always been tilting by and large towards in favor of China. And if we have to be able to tilt that balance in favor of India, one of the parameters is to get our infrastructure right. Otherwise, we won't be able to get our forces and the infrastructure and the equipments onto the border for a quick reaction.
The standoff with China that began this summer has underlined India's vulnerabilities. With no agreement yet on disengaging forces, India has been rushing equipment and artillery ahead of winter to Ladakh.
I don't think India is left with a lot of different choices in that sense. So we have been strengthening our winter deployment in terms of food, ammunition, and all kinds of things to the border areas. So we are looking at a longer-term engagement.
While it will take time to complete some of these roads, India hopes they will dramatically improve its ability to protect a disputed border that has turned volatile. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, read, and share all the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news, information, and great features.
This news from VOA Asia. South Korea Wednesday proposed allowing abortion up until the 14th week of pregnancy, all part of a new law designed to comply with a landmark ruling by the Constitutional Court that struck down a decades-long ban. All of the big stories come your way through the day at VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Resiliency funds are helping Black-owned businesses stay afloat during the coronavirus pandemic in the United States. The Oakland African American Chamber of Commerce says it's raised $1 million and expects to award grants to some 150 recipients, ranging from $2,500 to $10,000. BOA correspondent Mariama Diallo reports on some of the businesses benefiting from these funds.
Mannequin Madness is a Black-owned business that received so-called resilience funds from the Oakland African American Chamber of Commerce to help make it through the coronavirus pandemic. Judy Henderson is the owner.
I'm standing here right now because we did get the resiliency fund. I only had enough to kind of just pay payroll for a couple of more months.
The $10,000 grant helped the company offer new services like a photography studio for dogs.
Now that we have some new initiatives, we have other revenue streams coming in, and that's what's helping to keep things up.
Dwayne James, fashion designer and entrepreneur, received a $5,000 grant. She used to sell her colorful dresses and headwear at festivals and conferences until most were canceled because of the pandemic. The funds helped add a new line to her business, face masks.
I think just the African American community in general We have a history of having to support each other, right? And so there are opportunities that are presented that we don't often qualify for. So oftentimes we have to turn to our neighbor and turn to people within our community to assist us, to help us. And so in a sense, that's what this resiliency fund has been for a lot of us business owners.
Something echoed by Kathy Adams, who heads the Oakland African American Chamber of Commerce.
Our black-owned businesses have been marginalized for so long, and we figured we had a call to action to do something.
The Resiliency Fund is one of several such programs created in the U.S. since the pandemic closed businesses earlier this year. The Oakland Group says the funds help offset not only the disproportionate impact the virus has had on African-American families, but also the difficulty black businesses have in landing bank loans. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
How to stay healthy. Wash your hands with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. Scrub thoroughly for 20 seconds. If you cannot wash your hands, use a hand sanitizer. Taking these steps can prevent not only coronavirus, but also colds and flu and other viruses.
COVID-19 restrictions have forced beaches to close near Australia's biggest city as scorching spring temperatures sent thousands of people to the coast. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Heading to the coast is a quintessential Australian pastime. But warmer weather in the southern hemisphere is testing the nation's plans to keep the coronavirus at bay. Visitor numbers are now limited, and two beaches south of Sydney were closed to avoid overcrowding. Swimmers also were told to avoid Bondi and Coogee, as thousands of people flocked to two of Sydney's most popular arcs of sand. COVID-19 marshals and the police have been on patrol to ensure people stayed a towel length apart. The authorities have said the public's response has been encouraging, but beachgoers have had mixed opinions about the safety measures.
I think it's pretty good. I think everyone's social distancing, so I think it's fine.
I'm absolutely outraged, to be honest. This is ridiculous. It's too many people. Yes, I am here as well, and I'm going to go have a swim, but, you know, we shouldn't be, should we?
Australia has recorded about 27,000 COVID-19 cases since the pandemic began, and 900 people have died. Most states and territories have managed to contain the coronavirus. Queensland has reported no new infections in the past day. Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk says the community is heeding hygiene and distancing advice.
Once again, I just want to congratulate Queenslanders for the great work that they have done. The results that we have had because of our health response has been because Queenslanders have listened. We have seen that time and time again, whether it's dealing with cyclones and natural disasters, whether it's dealing with bushfires. Queenslanders come together. It's an incredible story.
Lockdown measures, however, still apply in the city of Melbourne. Residents can only leave home for essential activities. Health officials there have said that restrictions will ease later this month if infection rates continue to fall. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
VOA Asia continues. A debate is raging around the United States over statues that were built to memorialize historical figures. Some champion those honored as heroes who helped build the country. Others say their involvement in slavery and colonialism taints their legacy. Michael Sullivan reports on the national debate over what to do with statues that some Americans see as a part of their cultural legacy and others as an offensive reminder of oppression.
Much of the debate is focused on the South, where memorials to the Confederacy have been toppled or defaced, and in some cases, peacefully removed by authorities. Some say the statues honor regional heritage, while others see them as a celebration of slavery and a racist past. In New York, some say the statue of President Theodore Roosevelt must also go, because it is demeaning to Native Americans and African Americans. Another target is Columbus, the Italian explorer who opened the Americas to colonization from Europe, with disastrous results for the original inhabitants, say critics. The debate has pitted Italian Americans who celebrate the explorer against those who celebrate the indigenous groups he conquered. What of other figures from history, politics, and culture? The people should decide, says this man in San Francisco.
It's direct action. Direct action is a lot more effective than going through a lot of democratic processes. It's civil disobedience.
Other targets are more puzzling. This San Francisco statue honors Miguel de Cervantes, the revered Spanish writer who was captured by pirates and spent 5 years as a galley slave. His statue was defaced but remains standing. Another target is in the American Southwest. Junipero Serra is the 18th century Spanish missionary whose legacy is cherished by Hispanic Catholics but rejected by many Native Americans.
He's the cause of our decline of our population, decline of our loss of languages, culture, religion.
Ortega says many tribal members have mixed Hispanic and Native backgrounds, so not all agree. A scholar who is also of mixed heritage says Sarah's case shows the complexity of the issue.
It pains me that people of my community, my indigenous and Hispanic ancestry, my mestizaje, as we call it, the blending of our cultures, would see one part or the other of our heritage as something to be reviled. I've devoted my whole life to trying to reconcile that. And here, in one singular moment, I'm literally watching it being torn apart.
Every generation must reevaluate its heroes, whether Columbus, Sarah, or U.S. presidents, says tribal leader Ortega.
We're making history. And so when 100 years from now, people are going to read this in textbook and say, this is what the people did to better the lives in America, to make sure there's more inclusion.
He wants an orderly process in making decisions, however. Professor Mendoza complains that critics often know little of history.
Let's hope that those who are doing this don't find themselves in a position to be honored someday, because there will be another group that will come along and desecrate the meaning of what they contributed to society as well.
The reevaluation continues as people ask who should be honored in public monuments and who should decide. Questions with no easy answers. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Now on VOA Asia, many polling places in the United States are reporting high turnout and long lines at voting stations even weeks before the election. A nonpartisan organization called Pizza to the Polls is doing its part to help make things a bit easier. Karina Bafrodzian has the story.
Scott Duncombe, a web developer from Portland, Oregon, has an important mission this election season. He is determined to make sure no American voters go hungry as they wait in line to cast their ballot during the presidential elections. Together with his friends Katie and Noah, Duncombe created Pizza to the Polls, delivering free pizzas to polling stations with traditionally high turnout.
Some friends of mine and I were watching the early vote happening in 2016, and we saw that there was really long lines, and we had some sort of extra money left over from another project involving the election that we hadn't spent yet. We thought, well, maybe we could just send the pizzas to these people. Maybe that would work. And so we did it, and people in line were really happy. The pizza place delivered it, and so then we tweeted about it, and other people got excited, and they wanted to give us money. So we thought, well, we'll take donations, and it'll be something we do for a day.
Like most simple but brilliant ideas, this one got extremely popular extremely fast. During the election season in 2016, Scott and his friends received more than $40,000 in donations that they spent on delivering free pizza in 24 states. During midterms in 2018, Pizza to the Polls received orders from 41 states and have successfully delivered over 10,000 pizzas to 611 polling stations. Communication with voters takes place through Twitter. People upload pictures of long lines to the social network's account and add the address of the polling station. The Pizza to the Polls volunteers immediately place an order at local pizzerias and deliver the food. On election day on November 3rd, Scott will be helped by up to 100 volunteers all over the country, each one ensuring that no voter shall go hungry, because no one should have to vote on an empty stomach. For Karina Bafrajan in Washington, NRI's VOA News.
Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our managing director, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Jim Stevenson, Keith Lane, and Doug Bernard. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Please stay safe and enjoy the day.